Thank you, Representative Witt. What the bill does is it extends property tax special assessment program for historic property. It modifies the definitions of current law, revamps provisions governing assessed value of historic property. It modifies the types of additions treated as not being new construction. It establishes the Historic Preservation Revolving Loan Fund to finance rehabilitation of historic property.
If there's not any other discussion on this, I would entertain a motion to refer this bill to Revenue Committee.
Mr. Speaker, I mean, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Crummell. Yeah, well, excuse me, did I open work session? Did I open work session? I opened work session, yeah.
Yeah, you do.
We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2272, Revenue, with no recommendation.
Right. Representative Crummell has moved to refer House Bill 2270 to the Revenue Committee without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, if not, so ordered. House Bill 2270, then, Dan, will go to Revenue without recommendation.
Okay.
Okay, I would open a public hearing on House Bill 2406. Committee members, find House Bill 2406. That's the one we're going to have a hearing on right now. Okay, Dan, you want to go ahead and give us a brief overview of this bill?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. What the bill does is it creates a micro-enterprise development program which makes $100,000 grants to local community, social service, or nonprofit development organizations to help develop and expand micro-enterprise businesses through loans and grants of up to $35,000. It authorizes up to $150,000 for micro-enterprise support organizations that positively impact an unserved or underserved distressed community. Authorizes the Oregon Community Development Department to administer and to contract for program implementation. It establishes grant award criteria and annual reporting requirements. It appropriates an unknown amount from state and federal funds for program operation. Micro-enterprise is small business, 5 or less employees, capitalized at less than $25,000. Public support of startup businesses is focused at enterprise that will have the greatest positive impact on the community, i.e. a greater number of employees, better capitalization, less risk. Micro-enterprise does not qualify as small business and therefore receives little or no support from other economic development programs. Hence, it is difficult for micro-enterprise to qualify for either commercial or public support. This is particularly true in smaller and rural communities that tend to be underserved or are economically distressed. This program was not requested in the governor's budget submission. Federal programs currently fund a portion of the financial requirements for an estimated 40,000 micro-enterprise entrepreneurs in Oregon.
Okay, thank you, Dan. I see Representative Merkley is here, who's one of the sponsors of House Bill 2406. Representative, would you like to come forward, please, and give us your testimony?
Greetings, Mr. Chair and committee members. Jeff Merkley from House District 16. I'm pleased to come and testify on this bill. This was a product of the Emerging Small Business Committee during the interim. The chair of that committee, Susan Morgan, would like to have been here to testify directly, but she's tied up on a very important budget task and asked me to come and represent the nature of the discussion that went forward in that committee. So I'll try to do so in a fairly succinct manner. As outlined in the summary of the bill, this is aimed at assisting with the efforts to launch entrepreneurial enterprises primarily by the poor and the disadvantaged people who are trying to launch very small enterprises that are not coming from the population that the Small Business Administration normally works with. This concept has been worked on by community development organizations in the past, and it also has a heritage from other nations that have had similar programs that have worked quite effectively. And the fundamental concept behind it is that a small business is one of the three main mechanisms by which poor individuals find their way out of poverty. One mechanism is education, the second is home ownership, and the third is launching a small business. So that is where this is targeted. And what you have before you is a pilot grant program to be funded at whatever level is filled in the blank near the end of the bill. The program would be administered by the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. They would fund one or more microenterprise organizations, and the maximum amount, as noted in the summary, would be $100,000. The structure in the bill for this grant program is parallel in many ways to the process through which we fund affordable housing in this state. That is, rather than have a sophisticated, detailed plan at a statewide level where we say, well, we're going to put this development here and this development there and so on and so forth, instead, we say, let's have the community organizations gear up and present us with their very best ideas of what would work in their particular part of the state. So in the parallel framework of affordable housing, this has worked very well. Many, many groups submit plans. The state sits back and evaluates these plans. I'll do a number of criteria and says, well, this is really well positioned to succeed, and this is what we should fund. And this process has been quite successful. It really empowers local parts of the local organizations around the state to understand their particular considerations much better than any statewide strategy could encompass. The applicant, the way under Section 6, the structure is laid out for how the department would evaluate the grant applications. They would look at the scope of the plan. They would look at the number of micro-entrepreneurs who would be reached under the plan. They would look at the support services in the distressed community and the ability to provide assistance, the ability to provide training and technical assistance, the ability of the organization to follow up with assistance in financial oversight, to do reports evaluating the outcome and the performance, the ability of the organization to be a credible ability to carry out their plan, the source and sufficiency of their operating funds, for example. The funds, the grants themselves, as structured under this bill, can be used in a number of ways that are outlined in section, I guess, 6, subsection 2, no, subsection 3. First of all, the funds that they apply for, they have to show that they have a match. And then they must use no more than 10% for administration. The actual purposes are to establish a revolving fund to make microloans, to satisfy a match, to use the funds to guarantee a larger source of funds for loans, or to directly provide training or technical assistance. So that's where the other 90% of the grant could go. And these organizations would submit their detailed plan, and what we would see is very different plans from very different types of organizations. This made a lot of sense to the interim committee. Whether it is funded at a smaller level or a larger level, it will stimulate an experiment in working with this third arm, this third mechanism through which people near the bottom often get out of being at the bottom. Again, education, housing, and small businesses. I think that the question has been raised, and while I'm speaking, I'd like to address it, of how does this play into a organized dialogue, if you will, over how this fits into the rest of the assistance we provide. And under Section 5, what you will find is a proposal to convene an interagency work group on microenterprise development. And a number of groups that have a background and relationship to these services are included. I think that it has been mentioned and may come up in testimony today, that other groups that should probably be included in that are workforce boards and small business administration. Anyway, on behalf of the chair of the interim committee and myself, Chair Morgan, we recommend this bill for your consideration.
Thank you, Representative. We appreciate you testifying and bringing this idea forward. Are there questions for Representative Merkley? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Representative Merkley. I want to say before I start a line of questioning that may sound unnecessarily critical, that I understand the concept that you're advancing here, and I'm very supportive of that. As I read your draft bill, it seemed to be very heavy on process. And I wasn't sure to what degree it was duplicative of efforts that were already ongoing by the department. I was also not sure how competitive it was with banks, because in some places $35,000 is not a microloan at all. And so if you could answer the two questions of how does it not replicate initiatives already underway at Oregon Community and Economic Development, and how is it not, why would someone qualify here and not qualify at a lending institution?
Thank you for that question, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. The situation with the bank is they are often receiving an applicant from someone who already has the background and ability to present a coherent business plan. What these organizations would do is to work with people to help them get to the point that they could make a successful application to a bank, or if a bank wasn't the suitable vehicle, to actually benefit from a direct lending program incorporated in these organizations. It's very feasible in my mind that a group might submit a plan for the way that their support organization will work that might not include lending at all, and might see in their particular community that banks can fill that role, and they would forge a partnership with a bank and make that part of their plan. While in other places, it might be that they feel that they can be much more effective by having, and they may envision loans that are $2,000 to $10,000 as part of their plan that a bank wouldn't be interested in because of the overhead of making the loan, and feel like they should will be able to meet a need much more directly by inserting themselves directly into the process. We could see plans that look quite different coming forward. And I guess that is a strategy question well worth considering, is whether out of this rather loose framework that allows for a lot of flexibility in proposals might come some very interesting results. It is a different approach than a highly structured plan to begin with.
If the chair would tolerate a couple of follow-ups.
Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Is there not a mechanism in which this could be administered through Oregon Economic Development? My question for asking that is, I know that you want to use not-for-profit social service organizations and local entities who may or may not have experience in developing business plans. It seems to me to give exactly this kind of entrepreneur the access to the best information possible, rather in a large body of it, rather than asking social service agencies that may or may not be adequately geared up to help with the development of successful business plans. Did you explore working through OEDD to accomplish this end without setting up what appears to be a parallel mechanism?
I wasn't intimately involved in the conversations that led to this bill, and I think that OECDD may be able to provide a more complete answer to your question. I would note that this process would be embedded in the department. The question is whether they were to directly try to work with disadvantaged and low-income individuals, or would work in collaboration and through groups selected through a grant process such as this. A related question or model is the individual development account model, and this concept is one in which as you save money, your savings earn a grant if you do one of the three things I mentioned before: go back to school, buy a house or start a small business. There are a number of groups that have started up in the last few years around the state called individual development accounts, organizations, that are providing this opportunity, and it's kind of, it's tied in a similar way. Instead of the brain trust that helped work on this is the Enterprise Foundation here in Oregon, and what they set up was a structure of working through community organizations that already have are very familiar in working with these particular populations. And so in the best possible world, this is a marriage between expertise with a group like OECD or Small Business Administration and so forth, and organizations that very much understand the challenges faced by this particular population.
One more, and then I...
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Having observed very closely one of the mechanisms that's employed by OEDD to dispense money at the local level right now through the regional committees, I have some reticence about creating yet more self-sustaining boards that are giving away public money at the local level. And I'm saying this as much for Mr. Burton's benefit, who's sitting behind you. In our last iteration of one of the multiple county regional strategy disbursements, of the 9 appointed folks, all appointed by county commissioners, 6 of them were in the cycle for election. And I worry about oversight where you've got local boards, and I understand the explanation that says community organizations are familiar with what's on the ground need and they're familiar with the applicants. But I would welcome some kind of comment about the control that you have on giving away money at the local level by boards that may or may not have any public oversight if you're using private charitable organizations.
The experience with the boards that you're speaking to, I don't have personal experience with, but my understanding of the idea in Section 6 is not that this money would flow through a local board, but through a statewide grant competition. So I have that in mind, in part because of the language here doesn't lay out a local board as an intervening level, and in part because I have in mind the Department of Housing and Community Development's model for statewide grants for housing development. But that structure, if I'm interpreting this correctly, may bypass the problem you're alluding to.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, and I don't know if you'll know, and if you don't know the answers to these, it's fine. I can ask them of other people that might. To qualify for a micro-enterprise type of loan, what type of collateral or down payment would the entrepreneur need to have, or would they need to have any? Or is this, they can get a loan at the $35,000 and...
The precise requirements would be dependent upon the individual organization's plan submitted for the grant competition, so you could see considerable variety from place to place. My expectation is what you would see is standards that are somewhat different than with conventional lending and more flexible and less demanding for collateral. Probably many of the families who are applying for these loans would have very little to no collateral in place.
Okay. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Crummell.
That sort of brings up another question then. National statistics show, try saying that fast, two in five businesses fails in the first 2 years and 3 out of 5 go out of business within the first 5 years that they're in business. So what happens if a person defaults?
I think that the key to this is that it is a pilot, and one of the things that will be monitored closely as laid out in Section 6 is reporting on exactly how successful this will be. I am not sure that we will find that these organizations succeed in their efforts. I do think it is worth exploring and finding out the answer to that. Not by putting millions of dollars into it, but by putting a couple hundred thousand dollars into it and seeing what fruit comes forward.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair. Representative Crummell?
I guess then another question sort of along the lines of the loaning process to the entrepreneur, and that is what kind of interest rate would it be a lower than competitive rate? Would it be a competitive rate with banks? Would it be, you know, higher than by 1 point, 20 points, you know, kind of where was the vision of the group with that?
The committee didn't discuss this question. My expectation, again, is that organizations would submit quite different plans. There are six groups that are in operation around the state, and I suspect if they were here, or maybe some of them are here, maybe some of them are going to testify. There's one in Medford, Klamath Falls, one in Roseburg, one in Lane County. Mercy Corps is launching an effort just this last year. Neighborhood Pride and the Housing and Urban Development has a program of this nature. I do not know details about these programs, but if I had to guess, I would guess that there's a wide diversity in their strategies.
Okay. And one more?
Yes, Representative. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. With regards to, you made a mention of Small Business Administration, with regards to the Small Business Administration and the help centers or helpful centers they have at the community colleges, and I know we just, I think, saw another bill about that. What kind of help through that mechanism would be available to these entrepreneurs as far as then being able to follow up and be plugged into potentially being able to qualify and get loans through the microenterprise fund?
There's quite a variety of possibilities. One is that Small Business Administration submits to actually be a microenterprise support organization themselves. They could submit a plan. A second is a group submitting a plan might actually develop a partnership with a Small Business Administration to utilize their expertise as part of their program to work with emerging entrepreneurs, microenterprise entrepreneurs. I don't think there is one set strategy in mind. I should mention one thing that Senator Morgan, Representative, I just promoted her. Representative Morgan asked me to mention that, and that is that this was viewed by the interim committee as a strategy that might play itself out differently in rural and urban areas, but could be a very effective strategy in both areas, that this is not peculiarly a rural or urban strategy. And I think her interest is certainly in how this could assist people in rural areas, and a plan that a rural organization might submit might look very different from that an urban organization might submit.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Brown, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, it looks like by reading on page 4, line 7 and 8, that there would be two funds established, one for direct loans and another fund established for guaranteeing loans with a commercial institution. Is that right?
Page 4.
Page 4, yeah, line 7 and 8.
This under this subsection, the key word is may. A microenterprise support organization may use. What this is laying out is the range of legitimate uses. An organization might come forward with their plan and say, what we really intend to do with the fund is to do a revolving fund. Or they may come forward and say, no, we don't plan to do that at all, but we do plan to guarantee loans because we feel like we can maximize the amount of money we can put out or lend out through that strategy. And another group might come forward and say, we're going to work with a community development bank or a local bank. We don't intend to make loans at all. We really want to use that money for training and technical assistance. So it wouldn't necessarily be all of these strategies in a single organization. And yet there could also be, should they submit a plan and choose to pursue that direction.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Carlson?
Thank you, Representative Merkley. This is a very intriguing proposal, and particularly for low-income people, the idea of assets is a way to move people out of poverty. You mentioned earlier, and I was in and out, so I apologize if you already went through this, about individual development accounts, which also do the same thing. Is there a tie or a connection between what you're talking about here specifically and these individual development accounts?
There is not a strong tie-in, but there is a piece. Some individual development account programs may only provide a match for housing, some for housing education, some for housing education and small business development. But in general, IDAs are not set up. There is not an organizational infrastructure to nurture people who wish to use those funds to go into small business. So that's kind of a gap, if you will, in the IDA strategy that this could fill. So if you, I could imagine, for example, somebody who had developed, say had saved $5,000 and a one-to-one match, if they were in an IDA program, had another $5,000 potential grant, if they go into business with an approved business plan, could then turn to a microenterprise organization and say, I have at least $10,000 in capital, I need to develop a plan, I'm going to need to borrow this amount more money. Can you help me put all these pieces together and help me launch this effort? And this might be something as, for example, there have been some small businesses launched through the IDA program. One was a card business, and the woman is in Portland, and I don't remember all the details, but I remember meeting her and seeing her cards. And that was it's a very small home-based business where she can be with her kids and do this other piece to try to support the family simultaneously.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions for Representative Merkley? Representative, I have a couple questions. Who do you generally would foresee as being one of these micro-enterprise support organizations? Can you tell us the type of entities? Would these be new entities? Would they be existing entities? What do you envision?
I should alert the committee that I think I'm speaking far beyond my expertise, so I'm engaging in a lot of generalized opinions for which the foundation may be a little bit infirm. I would envision groups like community development organizations. There is a network of there's an association of Oregon community development organizations called AOCDO. They exist around the state. They work on affordable housing. Some of them have some pieces of this already. For example, there was a group in Portland, Rose Community Development Corporation, Rose CDC, that had a program to help people set up small daycares in their home. That would be an example of a microenterprise. But mainly I envision groups that are working with the poor disadvantaged in some current capacity. They understand the population, they're trusted by the population, they're unlikely to make the sort of mistakes that a group completely unfamiliar with that population might make. It but could range from a CDC to I could envision a group that works with rehabilitation, a nonprofit that works with rehabilitation issues undertaking such a role.
Do you typically envision these being nonprofit, community nonprofit organizations?
I do. I think there's very little room for profit to be made in working in this particular field.
The matching dollars provision on page 4 on line 13, any grants that are made by the micro enterprise support organization has to be matched with at least an equal dollar. Where do you generally think these matching dollars would come from?
If it follows the path that happens with affordable housing, they will come from an enormous variety, because it basically says to organizations, use your imagination, and they will go to their counties, they'll go to their cities, they will go to foundations and ask for the money, they'll explore whether or not the organization has funds that they have raised through their spaghetti dinners that they want to dedicate to a match. It will range tremendously. But those are the common types of places that a CDC might find these funds.
Could you tell the committee briefly the individual development account? I think we had a bill on this last session that was your bill Can you tell me what the status of that is and how that program works?
Yes. The individual development account philosophy is that one of the major barriers to home ownership or education is the ability to save money when you're very poor. It's tremendously hard work to save money when you're working a service job, $6 to $10 an hour, and you have children. And so the concept is that if you provide a matching grant program, you will basically be helping people who are tremendously motivated to help themselves. Because somebody who can save $3,000 to $5,000 on their own while earning a small service wage is a tremendously motivated individual and someone who's likely to succeed. And so it zeroes in to help people prepared to help themselves. And the general philosophy, and each organization that sponsors an IDA may take a different strategy, is that the grant, the person provides at least half the funds. The matching grant then is provided if they undertake one of those three items: to buy a home, to launch a small business, or to return to school. And there is a group in Portland area called Portland Regional IDA Program. It developed from a start at one particular nonprofit, Human Solutions. There are a number of other groups around the state that are now pursuing the IDA concept. I have not seen a recent report summarizing how they're doing, but I know that such a report would be available for the committee and could be provided.
And you'd see this program as something that's really outside of the scope of that, because this one's going to focus specifically on a new emerging small businesses that fall within this definition.
They're certainly complementary, and I could imagine some organizations providing IDAs might say this is a tool that we ought to incorporate within our house also.
And you see this program really being tailored at lower income individuals as a method in which they can start businesses to try to raise themselves up economically.
Exactly.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Walker?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment that I see Bill Goldsmith out in the audience, and I hope he's signed up to testify. He represents the Oregon Micro Enterprise Network, and I think he can answer a lot of these questions that Representative Merkley is beginning to be a little squeamish about.
Mm-hmm. We just wanted to hold his feet in the fire a little bit.
he
passed. He passed.
Now the committee can hear the experts.
Representative Johnson had one last point you wanted to make before we let you out of here.
Just a question. You mentioned that a woman had partaken of this program and had gone into the car business.
Card business.
Thank you.
Yes, and that was within the IDA program, not within a micro enterprise nurturing structure.
Thank you for that clarification.
You're very welcome.
Okay, are we all done with Representative Merkley for now? Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Mr. Bill Goldsmith, please. Welcome, Mr. Goldsmith, and state your name for the record, please, and feel free to give us your testimony.
Thank you. Honorable Chair Witt, honorable members of the Smart Growth and Commerce Committee, my name is Bill Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Micro Enterprise Network, Post Office Box 51083, Eugene, Oregon, 97405. I speak to you today in support of House Bill 2406, the Oregon Micro Enterprise Development Act, on behalf of our 27 member organizations. These organizations, the names of which you'll find in the information packet which you have, currently provide or support services to help Oregon's smallest businesses succeed. During the past year, our membership has worked with programs in other states and members and staff of the House Interim Committee on Emerging Small Business to draft proposed legislation which would support the maintenance and development of a broad range of services to Oregon's disadvantaged micro-entrepreneurs. House Bill 2406 is the result of these efforts. This bill creates a permanent statewide infrastructure that coordinates existing resources to maintain and expand a system of microenterprise development programs. As I found out in talking with many of you over the last few weeks, many of you are intimately familiar with small businesses and the challenges and problems that go along with that. However, the term microenterprise is a relatively new one, and it identifies a significant but often ignored subset of small businesses. While the definition of small business can span a range up to several hundred employees and several million dollars in sales, microenterprises are businesses with fewer than five employees, the majority of which have an owner who is the sole operator and worker. In addition, these owners are generally disadvantaged economically, educationally, or physically. The majority of those served by microenterprise development programs are those with low income or low wealth. These are the targeted beneficiaries of House Bill 2406. In Oregon, there are about 263,000 businesses with fewer than five employees. Of these, it's estimated that about 45,000 would qualify as microenterprises, that is, whose owner experiences one or more barriers to access business and financial services generally available to other entrepreneurs. These businesses and thousands more potential businesses like them, are found everywhere in Oregon, in both urban and rural areas. These are the businesses that together form the locally crafted economic fabric of our communities. It's time that Oregon had a legislatively directed microenterprise program to create a sharp focus on these small but precious enterprises that make up the vast majority of our business landscape. The nurturing of these enterprises is essential to the creation of a diverse economy. Self-employment becomes an even more important option as the workplace becomes even more fluid, dynamic, and entrepreneurial. Microenterprise does work. Oregon needs a permanent statewide microenterprise infrastructure to provide equal opportunity to all Oregon's entrepreneurs to have a chance to succeed in business. Microenterprise development is a business-building strategy that benefits entrepreneurs and the general economy in both distressed rural and distressed urban areas. It's a wealth-building strategy that allows those families whose incomes are low to find a path to self-sufficiency in family-friendly environments. The first microenterprise development programs in the United States emerged some 15 years ago as a reflection of successful experiences with the informal sector entrepreneurs in developing countries. While initially focusing on small amounts of credit, as had programs such as the famous Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, these early United States practitioners soon recognized the diverse challenges their clients faced in starting and operating a business in this country. As a result, the general program emphasis shifted from credit to training and technical assistance, and more recently to market access and asset building activities, such as the IDAs that Representative Merkley was talking about. In the past 15 years, nearly 700 new microenterprise development programs have emerged across the country. These programs offer a core set of integrated program elements designed to respond to the unique needs of their clients. These program elements include outreach, training and technical assistance, ongoing assistance, follow-up, access to credit, access to markets, and asset building. Initial evaluations of the strategies of microenterprise development indicate that these programs do make a difference. The Aspen Institute's five-year longitudinal study found significant income and asset increases among low-income entrepreneurs participating in microenterprise development programs. Over half the participants had moved out of poverty by the end of the study period. Microbusinesses showed a high survival rate of nearly 60%, and reliance on public assistance declined in both dollars and numbers of participants. Recently, the federal government has recognized the value of microenterprise development by enacting and fully funding the Program for Investment in Microentrepreneurs Act, or PRIME, which, under the auspices of the Small Business Administration, will this year begin helping provide funds for delivering training and technical assistance to low-income entrepreneurs. States are also beginning to mobilize their resources to help their communities participate in this new and innovative strategies. I'd like to tell you briefly about two of the states where microenterprise legislation has already been enacted. In 1995, Virginia passed the Virginia Initiative Program to fund business skills training, technical assistance, microloans, and follow-up assistance to individual entrepreneurs who lacked access to business training or traditional credit. Many of these are minorities, women, and low-income Virginians. In the first 3 years of the legislation, Virginia's $3 million investment has been leveraged into a $10 million business development program, 3,000 people were trained in basic business skills and business management. 370 new businesses were created, and 436 businesses were able to expand, creating 1,031 new jobs and retaining another 632. $5 million in microloans were given to 425 entrepreneurs. The Virginia program is administered by the Department of Housing and Community Development, which funds 15 community-based sites around the state. Nebraska, a state similar in size and nature to Oregon, passed its Microenterprise Development Act in 1997 and currently provides $500,000 annually to fund training and lending programs covering 47 counties. In 1999, these programs made over $1 million in microloans and created and retained a total of 412 jobs. In Nebraska, a private microenterprise partnership fund has leveraged state funds with private bank dollars to create a large microlending pool. While the act is administered by the Economic Development Department, it in fact contracts its responsibilities to this financial intermediary. I give you these examples to illustrate the benefits that can emerge from microenterprise legislation. Self-employment is work. Oregon needs microenterprise legislation to correct the traditional institutional bias that equates small with insignificant and that perceives that 250,000 Oregonians who are self-employed as neither employer nor employee. This condition exists in our workforce programs, our economic development strategies, our family assistance programs, and our community development programs. There are plenty of federal and state resources that can be targeted to microbusinesses, but to do so requires a supportive and coordinated state administrative environment. This state has a long history of using public funds to support economic development activities. The question is how far that down that assistance reaches, or up, depending on which way you look. Microenterprises are not the usual targets of such assistance. Taken individually, these small businesses make little impact. But we're in a new economy where we can no longer rely on the mono-economies of the past for our economic stability. We need to look at new alternative strategies to help our economy survive in the 21st century global economy. We need to have citizens, both rich and poor, with a diverse set of skills that allow each of them to respond entrepreneurially to new and existing opportunities, to adapt creatively to their economic environment. The experience offered by the opportunity to start one's own business is of a different order than that of being trained as a wage worker. The business, personal, and social skills survive, even if the business does not, and the individual persists as a rugged participant in a vibrant and creative economy. I want to touch briefly on some of the issues that have been raised over the last couple of weeks in our discussions, both with the administrative staff and several of committee members. This is a program that does not compete with, but rather complements, the work of Oregon's network of small business development centers. These centers emerged 20 years ago in response to community needs for a program that provided management and technical assistance to current and prospective small business owners. Similarly, new microenterprise development programs are responding to a current unmet need in a specific subset of small businesses. Providing business development services to disadvantaged entrepreneurs presents a set of unique challenges requiring the development of new strategies and new programs. Microenterprise development programs go beyond the traditional business education and counseling services offered by business development centers by adding targeted outreach programs, microcredit programs, ongoing support and assistance, access to markets, and most recently, asset development activities. Even within the training programs offered by microenterprise programs, the scope has been adjusted to include teaching financial literacy and family budgeting skills, building self-confidence, and teaching business behavior. Some of our programs provide program accommodations, such as childcare, transportation, home visits, and bilingual assistance as a means of helping participants overcome barriers to service. Our Oregon programs currently work cooperatively with local business development centers. In Lane County, the center actually houses a collaborative microenterprise program. I'm currently working with Lincoln County Center to develop community support for a new program in that coastal area. It's quite possible that additional centers may appropriately choose to integrate microenterprise development into their current delivery system under this act. microenterprise development program participants receive the basic business literacy training required to make them effective and appropriate future clients of the programs business development centers offer. And touch a little bit on microcredit. Microenterprise development is a lot more than just lending. While most programs in developing countries are lending-focused, most programs in the United States are training-led. A recent survey found that only 11% of microenterprise participants nationally are borrowers, even though assessments continually indicate a greater need for capital. As our programs experiment with different lending products to continue to try to meet these needs, current loans are made to participants using underwriting standards appropriate to the characteristics of the borrower and expected loan losses. Generally, loans given by microenterprise development programs are accompanied by required intensive training. The capital need for loan funds, in the most cases, are being met by partnerships with local banks and credit unions, local community development block grants, and other community sources. The program funding is visioned for House Bill 2406 is primarily focused on providing core support for training and technical assistance activities rather than on building loan pools. Who should administer the program? While microenterprise development is part poverty alleviation strategy, part an individual development strategy, part social service, part economic development, part community development, when all is said and done, it's about creating and maintaining small businesses. This is the reason why we support placing responsibility for the administration of this legislation with the Oregon Economic Community Development Department. Later on in this session, I hope you'll get a chance to approve the creation of a new Office of Small Business within the department, as recommended by the Governor's Small Business Council, of which I'm a member. This increased focus on small business within the department seems to create the most favorable environment for the Oregon Microenterprise Development Act. In terms of administrative burden the Act might place on the Department, let me say that House Bill 2406 allows for the contracting of many of these activities with a statewide microenterprise support organization, such as the Oregon Microenterprise Network. If we were chosen to fill that role, we would be responsible for administering grants, providing program training and technical assistance, and developing program performance and outcome measures. The department would have oversight and reporting responsibilities. We're in conversation with the department currently to develop a blueprint as to how this relationship might be structured. And finally, let me talk about the level of financial support required to create a permanent statewide infrastructure for microenterprise development. The first thing that we propose is an annual appropriation of $125,000 from OECDD. These funds would be used exclusively as the required match for $250,000 in federal prime funds to create stable core funding for microenterprise program sites. In addition, we propose that a training and technical assistance fund of up to $400,000 annually be appropriated from either Workforce Investment Act funds or Temporary Assistance to Needy Families reserves to provide training services to low-income and very low-income individuals and to the unemployed. Neither of these state-administered federal programs currently offers entrepreneurial training services, although it's permitted under the guidelines. If fully funded, this program should be able to support about a dozen microenterprise development sites around the state, more than doubling the current statewide capacity. I should point out that we're currently discussing the possibility of departmental support for these allocations with OECDD and other potential state partners. While we understand the financial constraints of the current legislative session, we propose that a redirection and reprioritization of currently available funds for the use of helping Oregon's smallest businesses succeed be a profitable and effective investment of Oregon's public resources. I'd like to call to your attention the letters from the U.S. Small Business Administration, the Florence Area Chamber of Commerce, and the Lane Community College Business Development Center, and also some of you may have gotten a letter from one of our participants, Deborah Rose O'Neill, and I'd like those submitted if possible as part of the testimony. And I'm prepared to answer any questions that the committee might have, and I want to thank Representative Merkley, although I think he's probably already gone, for doing a wonderful job of interpreting some of the questions that you asked, and if you have any follow-ups for Andy, I'd be happy to respond.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. That's a very comprehensive testimony. We appreciate that. Questions for Mr. Goldsmith? Or Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, towards the end of your testimony, you were talking about the $125,000 from OECDD and matching that with $250,000 in federal funds. So are those dollars that you would envision as being leveraged?
Yes.
So that then,
one to two.
So that instead of actually having $250,000, we would have $375,000 to put into this fund for the development of the support organizations, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And then, if I may follow up, Mr. Chair?
Follow up, Representative.
Then a little bit further, you were talking about the use of Workforce Investment Act funds and the TANF or Temporary Assistance to Needy Families funds. Would those then be dollars that would be getting to the entrepreneur? Or are those dollars that would be still yet again supporting the support organization?
Those are primarily, Representative Crummell, training dollars used for training, and so they would pay for training and technical assistance services provided by the support organizations directly to the entrepreneurs.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
I guess I'm kind of curious at what point the dollars, because in the first part of your testimony you mentioned that in Oregon there are 260,000 plus businesses with fewer than five employees, and about 45,000 of these would qualify as micro enterprises whose owner or potential owner experiences barriers to being able to get into the market. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, at what point are we taking the dollars and putting them where, you know, guys sitting in the back row can come in and apply for microenterprise funds to help him get his business up and running?
You're talking about a loan?
Loans, grant, whatever the case may be.
May I answer?
Okay. Yes,
yeah.
Please.
Historically, microenterprise programs don't offer grants to support businesses, although that has been tried at some of the extremely low loan levels, $100 to $500, where the cost of maintaining the loan program far outweigh the amount delivered. In general, loan funds are available to entrepreneurs upon the development, going through a training program, a technical assistance program, and these funds currently really are being provided by local community resources. Banks are providing revolving loan funds because they see a strong advantage in building their future clients, really future bankable businesses through these programs. In Lane County, U.S. Bank and Wells Fargo have both contributed loan funds, and OUR Federal Credit Union, which is a community development financial institution, is providing the lending services. I believe Wells Fargo also recently supported the Mercy Corps loan fund as well. I really see the state funds as supporting the training, technical assistance, follow-up services, and market access programs that these entrepreneurs need even more, it turns out, and to a greater extent than we had imagined, than loan dollars.
I don't think this bill contemplates grants.
This bill does not contemplate.
Yeah, grants. Just if you look at page 4, line 4, it says a microenterprise support organization may use grant funds received to satisfy matching funds requirements for federal or private grants supporting microenterprise development activities. Those are grants to the microenterprise organization.
That's correct.
And then they would establish a revolving fund from which to make micro loans, and then they will also provide funding for training and technical assistance. And it specifically says that not more than 10% of the grant funds received are for administrative expenses.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the purpose here is not to make grants to these emerging businesses, but to make loans and provide training and technical assistance to them. And the micro enterprise organization has to keep its administrative expenses to not more than 10%.
That's correct.
I misunderstood that at first, but if that clarifies it for anybody. Okay. Representative Crumwell, are you, do you have another question?
I do, if that's... If
yeah,
that's
go ahead.
And sort of piggybacking on what you're saying and what Mr. Goldsmith was mentioning with regards to banks, I guess what I'm wanting to make sure of here is that you know, if the guy in the back row is going to be sent to a bank, and let's say he's sent to U.S. Bank to get a small business loan or micro enterprise loan, whatever they want to call it, does he then walk in there and he's gone through the training program, he's done, you know, he's gone through all the steps, he's put together his business plan, everything's looking pretty good. Does he then walk into the bank and be told, gosh, you know, we really got to have 20% down, or we got to have 40% down, and without that, you know, this loan that you're asking for $28,500 isn't going to be able to be approved.
No,
so are we then I'm just wanting to make sure that we really are knocking down barriers for people to be able to get into, take their creative talents and get into their own.
Representative, let me create the scenario for each microenterprise development program will have to have a microcredit program as well. In other words, that's one of the required elements of being called a microenterprise development program. The usual scenario will be that a microentrepreneur will make his first loan. That small loan, although up to $35,000, most loans are within the $500 to $5,000 range, will make that first loan with the microenterprise development organization. Building on that credit history, then, the relationship with the banks will then come into play for either a second loan or a third loan that occurs when this individual becomes bankable. The problem is that most small businesses, especially those operated by low-income individuals, are not bankable. So they get their first loan from the microenterprise development support organization, and then that possibly we use step loans a lot. In other words, we give a small loan, and we say in 3 months if you've done this, come back and get another loan. We'll use step loan, and then at the end of that step loan period, when both the participant and the program feel that there's a bankable situation, then we'll make that step. The other thing that we do is work cooperatively with lending agencies to provide larger loans than we're able to provide, where we take a guarantee kind of position in this.
Okay. One more question,
Mr. Zinner-Frommel.
Thank you. Could a Chamber of Commerce potentially be a local support organization?
Sure.
And
you'll see a letter in there that is from the Florence Chamber of Commerce that's really interested in developing it. And I think what's really unique about this strategy as it develops, again, these are community-based programs. And the most exciting part about forming new programs are the partnerships and collaborations that you find at the local level to make these possible. These programs don't exist without the cooperation of a local community development corporation, without the cooperation of a local bank. We have a wonderful collaboration in Lane County, and I keep talking about it because that's sort of my roots, but where the Business Development Center, OUR Federal Credit Union, and the Saturday Market have gotten together to provide this kind of collaborative program. So we have marketing, we have credit, we have training and technical assistance, and Elaine Phillips, who is here, is the primary provider of service and operates on a casework basis to make sure that nobody slips through the kind of cracks that you're talking about.
Great, thank you.
Representative Walker.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you, Mr. Goldsmith, for coming and recognizing you as one of my constituents. And you have really done a tremendous job with your testimony and working in our community to make this happen, and I appreciate that. I have one inconsistency that I need to sort of figure out where it comes from, and Representative Johnson brought that to my attention when she talked about $35,000 amount. In the bill, it says the loans are up to $35,000, but in your materials and also in my discussion with Sean Winkler-Rios in my office, It was all indicated there was a $25,000 cap. So can you explain the difference?
Well, let me explain where that's coming from. The Small Business Administration has a microloan program, and that's administered in this state by Cascades West, who's one of our members, and also now the program in Medford, Southern Oregon Women's Access to Credit, is now a microlender, and I believe there are several other people thinking of applying for that. They have raised their limit to $35,000, the SBA has. So we thought that since we were trying to make the bill consistent with federal language, that we would also do that. In actual practice, nationally, the average microenterprise loan is $10,000. In practice in Oregon, in our programs, that's more like $3,000 to $4,000 to $5,000. And within Lane Microbusiness, it's not been unheard of for us to do a $500 loan or a $1,000 loan to support a business that doesn't have a large capital needs, but just a little bit of a start to get going. So that's the actuality, and the language was in the bill simply to conform to the federal guidelines, which seem to be emerging.
Great. Thank you very much. That's my question.
Representative Monis Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we use taxpayer money for programs like this, I want to make sure that it really is making a difference. It really is benefiting Oregon. And I think the two outcomes I want, and I think you might have said this in your testimony, but I'd like to hear it from you again. The two things I would like to see if we really do go forward with this is that it would increase the number of people who could enter into small business, as well as actual numbers. And do you have those kinds of comparisons? And the other thing would be to decrease the number of small business failures. You know, if we didn't have the program, are we still going to have the same number who fail? Do you have statistics?
Again, the only sort of complete evaluation was the Espen Institute, and they found that 60% of the businesses that were started in those programs still existed. I thought it was 3 to 4 years after their beginning. This compared favorably with an SBA statistic at the time of about 40% businesses who had that. All of the evaluation done now is on a national basis. We're really hoping that as a part of this program, we can, and there are national efforts to develop program performance standards and evaluation outcomes that relate specifically to the items that you're raising. But the initial evaluation that was done on microenterprise development programs, and that was, I think, 1994 to 1998 by the Espen Institute, indicated positive movement in all of those outcomes.
Follow up. So you're saying that there is an increase of people who are entering into small business enterprises with your program. Can you say that? And can you say that I have heard
I have the second part of your question. I'm not sure how I would answer the first part of your question.
Okay.
I mean, I think that the whole area of small business is underserved in the state in terms of assistance. I mean, with the amount of small businesses that exist, over a quarter of a million that are five and fewer, not to mention those that are higher, but certainly in the self-employment area, I believe our programs can be extremely instrumental in helping people who either already have businesses or more likely already have the skills, but not the businesses, to develop the capacity to create those businesses. So I guess the answer to your first part of your question is yes. And as far as the survival rate, initial evaluation results indicate that the programs are capable of sustaining jobs as well as creating them.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have heard the number that usually those who enter into small businesses, 50% survive, and you're saying with your program, 60% survive, so there is 10%.
Right.
It keeps 10% more businesses alive.
Right.
Is
sort of like...
But many of the people that we're helping wouldn't be in business to begin with unless there were program services available.
Okay.
And maybe that's the first part of your question.
Representative Johnson?
Thank you, sir. I have a couple of questions. First of all, I want to thank you for your testimony. It addressed a lot of the points that I was raising, and I appreciate how comprehensive it was. I noticed from the brochure, your brochure, that Representative Crummell was nice enough to share with me, that U.S. Bank appears to be one of your sponsors.
That's correct.
In that context, have you developed a relationship with them that might make them particularly receptive to your clients coming forward to seek conventional commercial loans or conventional loans?
I think we're just in the beginning stages of that. I think U.S. Bank, through their foundation, recognizes the importance of providing economic opportunity to low-income individuals in the state. And there's a receptiveness on the part of that organization, as well as other bank foundations, private foundations, banks looking to satisfy their CRA requirements to make these kinds of investments. Even after 2.5 years in Lane County, we're still working on people to make them bankable. But certainly the expectation, I think, on the part of the bankers that I talk to, and the reason that they have an interest in this program is because they do believe that we eventually, and by helping low-income individuals begin their own business, develop some businesses that are bankable for them. And that is the relationship that we're looking to develop.
If I can just, excuse me 1 minute, Representative Johnson, because of time constraints tonight, I don't want to run past 5:30. In fact, I've already promised Representative Walker I would not. we're going to complete our hearing on the bill we're on, which is 2406, and we probably will get to House Bill 2104. But the other bills on the agenda today, we're not going to have time to get to. We'll have to reschedule those. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Johnson.
Two questions. One quick one, one slightly longer. Has U.S. Bank been generous to you in underwriting your not-for-profit?
Yes, they've provided funds for our training and technical assistance activities. And they are also, I believe, providing assistance to some of our programs as well.
In what range? Six figures? Five figures?
Five figures.
And the last question, and I'm glad Mr. Burton is back. I understood from your testimony that you might not be so much looking for new money, given how tight it appears this budget cycle may be, but that you might be able to work out an arrangement wherein, with legislative authorization, you create a program and redirect some of OECD's money. Is that the line of discussion that you're having with the department right now?
Yes, that is. In other words, we've asked them to relook at their appropriation and try to find $125,000 to create the matching fund. And we're also having some discussions with the governor's workforce coordinator around those same issues.
I should say that considerably changes my approach to this bill. Given that this is not new money, this is redirected money with already inside OEDD's budget, with an idea of creating a new program or a new track of service delivery and a new clientele base with the same amount of money. And this is not a request over and above what OEDD might be coming to the legislature looking for in this budgetary request.
I guess what I want to stress is that we haven't agreed to anything yet.
Thank you.
We're trying to convince them that this is a worthwhile.
Representative, this makes you more favorable or less, more disposed or less disposed?
As long as it is looking for money that is inside OEDD already and not looking for new money, it makes me more disposed.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate knowing that. I think Representative Carlson and then Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony, and I just wanted to tell you that I'm enormously comforted to know that I can put on my applications that I'm a micro business owner rather than self-employed. I started my business in '96, and we had a conversation prior to this meeting where I recall telling you that I can really relate to some of the instances that you're talking about. I'm not sure that it applies only to people who are in poverty, if you will, because you've heard the adage that most of us are a paycheck or two away from poverty anyway. But
applying for a home equity loan, I can give them my husband's pay stub for the last month. I come with a stack of papers about that thick with my entire business plan, all of my clientele, you know, my tax returns for the last 7 years, all of those types of things. It's enormously difficult. So I guess the part that intrigues me the most is your statement. I covered it up here. On the second to the last page of your testimony, the program funding envisioned is primarily focused on providing core support for training and technical assistance rather than building on loan pools. I know I personally, it took me a while to establish how much to charge per hour, how to build a client base, you know, what equipment that I would need to purchase and that type of thing. So I think that this is really a valuable service, and I'm wondering, perhaps from your experience you've had so far, how do you do outreach? Because I didn't know in starting my business that anything was really out there for me. How do other people find out that it's out, that it's possible for them?
Right. It's really one of the most critical services that we provide. We've done extensive outreach in programs with AFS, with the Employment Department. We're trying to create that linkage at this point, so that people who have business ideas but don't have the wealth to implement them have access. So our outreach primarily is to those public agencies and programs that are already involved with and trying to deal with poverty alleviation, although not all of them on a long-term basis that asset development can provide. We're involved in a demonstration program. I had a demonstration program in Lane County that did a survey of 1,000 public housing residents. And 600 of them indicated a desire to start their own business. The entrepreneurial spirit is out there, I think that we're constantly inventing new ways to find those people who are interested in starting their own businesses and trying to let them know that our programs exist. We also outreach to business development centers, banks, SCORE, to let them know that the folks who walk in their doors, that they feel unable at the moment to provide resources and assistance to have a place to go. And I suppose in that case, we're the court of last resort, and we really try not to turn people away. People may decide not to start their own business after they spend several sessions with us or even go through an entire training program, but we actively seek referrals from those institutions that are providing very excellent small business services to a segment of the population but can't offer it to everybody, especially low-income entrepreneurs.
One follow-up.
Representative Carlson?
I noted in your attached materials that 78% as a client profile of the people that are micro-business owners are women.
Yes.
And those, could you comment perhaps on some of the special circumstances? I know one of the driving forces for me was that I could be at home, I could be with my children, and I think that sort of lends a different perspective to it than simply looking at it from a general economic development perspective.
I came to Micro Enterprise from the Saturday Market, where I was the general manager for 12 years, and sort of like you, all of those folks have been doing Micro Enterprise for years and years, but didn't know what to call it. 65% of our members at that point were women, and most of them had chosen to develop a home-based or micro-enterprise or self-employed business so that they could create the kinds of flexible hours that they needed to raise their families and to be with their families, so that they could avoid the sort of double taxation of childcare services required to be in the wage and asset building part of their lives, and many of them finding skills that they had developed along their lifetime that could be translated into a business, but they needed a special set of conditions other than just being a wage earner to make that come real and to provide an economic contribution to their families. And as you know, many of micro-entrepreneurs are engaged in what we now call income patching, which is trying to develop enough income sources to keep a family afloat through all members of the family to work, both men and women.
Okay, Representative Bates.
This should be an easy one. the $125,000 from OECDD that you would use for the matching funds from the federal government, are those new matching funds that OECDD couldn't get without going through this program?
Yes.
So that this...
Actually, those funds are not available to OECDD. They're only available to community-based programs. But our programs have met together and have decided that we would write a statewide, a collaborative statewide grant for those funds using the network as the hub of that. So the OECDD funds can be, if I understand your question correctly, Representative Vape, OECDD funds can be used to match that money, but OECDD could not develop that money without applications from, there'd be no place to match if there were no applications from community-based programs.
Follow-up. Yeah. And then you were saying you had to be in the microenterprise program to get those matching funds. Okay, the follow-up question then is, you want another $400,000 for Work Investment Act, or for training, for technical training. Could that fund be increased and some of that maybe leveraged money instead of $400,000 just from general funds?
Of the $400,000, you mean?
Yeah.
Each of those programs... I have trouble answering that question because each of those programs have match requirements on their own already, and it got complicated when we tried to look at that. So what we did was create this 1-2 match for the actually general funds, but the federal funds that we envision being coordinated to use in this kind of a program, I think that match would have to be developed as a part of the work group response. I'm sorry, I can't answer your question better.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, sir. I realized I only asked half my question. I've been sitting here thinking about how I didn't round this out fully. I asked you whether or not your effort was duplicative of anything that OEDD was doing, and I've been sitting here thinking about Clatsop Community College that's in my district and the fact that they have a very active small business development section. And as I've reflected on presentations that I've seen them do, they're trying to do exactly the same thing that you're doing. With limited resources. Contrast what you're doing with Clatsop Community or any of the small business development.
I think that the biggest difference that exists within these complementary business development strategies is that microenterprise development programs concentrate almost exclusively on low-income and very low-income individuals and families. This presents a whole different complex of issues and barriers that are not easily nor inexpensively addressed by business development centers that are trying already to serve the other 80% of small businesses within this state. So I think I think as Representative Merkley said in his testimony, and rightly so, one of the platforms that we see possible for the development of the additional needed programs to cover this state is certainly the small business development centers that we hope that will participate. Two of them are already members of our organization. One of them already has a microenterprise development program as a part of what they're doing. But that program recognizes that different strategies and different programs are needed to address the business development, very basic business development needs of low-income individuals that are needed to address those individuals who need to enhance their already successful or trying to be successful endeavors.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Goldsmith.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. I think we have John Blatt here as well to testify on this bill. Blatt, state your name for the record and go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Great. My name is John Blatt. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Community Development Organizations. I'm going to be very brief and try to get out of here as quickly as possible. I'm going to limit my testimony to just 2 points that I want to bring up. When you first go into low-income communities, one of the first ways you recognize that you're in a low-income community is the lack of business or boarded-up businesses, typically. What I think this bill will do, is help create businesses in low-income communities and help alleviate what most researchers call economic isolation, is the fact that businesses don't locate there, people can't be employed close to home, and the money that's made in those communities and resides in those communities leaves the community very quickly. So I think there's a lot of benefit to creating businesses that are located in low-income communities. I think that's going to be a great benefit down the road. The second piece that I just want to comment on briefly is that this complements a lot of the work that my groups are doing. The groups that are members of my organization, as Representative Merkley mentioned, they are developing low-income housing all over the state. They also do economic development, usually focused around physical redevelopment. Some of the housing developments that they will put together will have retail or office space within them on the first floor. Sometimes they develop commercial real estate if it's needed in the area. We have two representatives from Umpqua CDC over here, which is based in Roseburg. One of the first projects that Umpqua CDC did was essentially a marketing collaborative for people doing secondary wood products, processing wood again. So that's one way they've been involved. Umpqua CDC also recently finished redeveloping the fishing pier in Port Orford. And as a result of that, the fishermen are going to be able to more easily get their boats in and out of the water. They're going to, they added a recreational lift because the bay at Port Orford is too rough to leave the boats in the water, so they have to get in and out of the water very quickly. So one of what CDCs tend to do is they create an environment where other businesses can be successful, whether it is creating a marketing collaborative or rebuilding a pier so that the fishermen can be more successful or create opportunities for recreation that weren't there before. CDCs try to create an environment that is conducive to other people coming in and doing what they know how to do, create businesses and create jobs and economic development. There was talk about individual development accounts. The individual development accounts generally generate about $3,000 to $5,000 in total. So you're talking about a very small amount of money that this program would be able to complement and add on to. The $3,000 to $5,000 could become equity into a new small business. It could be and then viewed as collateral to some smaller loans. So those are some of the ways that these work together. I know the committee has already been heard a lot of testimony from people who know a lot more about the details of this than I do. So at that, I would open up any questions that the committee might have.
Thank you, Mr. Blatt. Questions for Mr. Blatt? Representative Brown?
Will this program or these types of programs have any impact on the unemployment in coastal communities or eastern Oregon communities, rural communities?
We would hope so. It depends on a little bit on where they get cited, and the people who are generally going to be eligible for this kind of a program, some of them are coming off of temporary assistance to needy families, the TANF program, the welfare. Some will be people who are growing from underemployment. They might be working at the local, the coastal communities are highly service-oriented because of the tourism industry. They may be working at a low-paying job, whether it's working as a short order cook or cleaning hotel rooms, and they may have an idea to start a business, and those are the kinds of people that this would be targeted at.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Blatt? Thank you, Mr. Blatt.
Great. Thank you.
Is there anybody else that would like to give testimony today on House Bill 2406? I should point out there are some -1 amendments here on this bill. We haven't specifically talked about those, but be aware of that and make sure you have that in your bill file. And we're not going to go into work session on this bill yet because it may need a little bit more work, but I would encourage members to give consideration to this bill and anticipate that we'll be seeing it again in the future. Okay. If nothing, anything else on that? Okay, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2406, and we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2104. And again, members, we will be done by 5:30 today. Mr. Doyle, I believe, is here to give testimony. Welcome, Mr. Doyle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Doyle. I'm the director of the International Division within the Department of Economic and Community Development. The bill in front of you today, House Bill 2104, basically is a bill that provides for clarification of some language that has historically been utilized for the state's foreign offices. The state of Oregon, like many other states, is moving towards using representation in their foreign trade offices as opposed to employees. The language in House Bill 2104 allows us to utilize these type of contractual representation for our foreign offices and provide them with the same type of exemptions underneath the statute that our traditional foreign trade offices have had by the use of employees. You may be aware or may not be aware that entering into this biennium, the state basically had three foreign trade offices in Tokyo, Japan, in Taipei, Taiwan, and then a shared office with the Port of Portland in Seoul, South Korea. During this biennium, the state has added three additional foreign trade offices through contract representation, utilizing trade management services in Mexico City, Mexico, which came on board in November of 2000, the representation bridge located in London, England, to represent us in the European Union, and also the Jebsen Consulting Group in Shanghai, China, to represent us within the Chinese mainland. The language in here provides clear authority for the state to utilize either employees or contractors to staff the foreign trade offices and thereby continue the statutory exemptions related to personal services, purchasing, office space leasing, and other issues relative to ORS 285A.075, paragraph 6, which basically, since I had to look this up myself today, deals with issues pertaining to overtime pay, use of the state printer, those type of initiatives, and this just basically provides exemptions for those.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Questions for Mr. Doyle? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, sir. Do you have any kind of a report that shows how many leads these foreign offices generate?
Sure. I can provide you with that report. The materials that you have in front of you will cover some of those type of things. Realizing that many of you are new to the legislature and many of you may or may not have much of a background in international trade, what I've tried to provide you in the packet is a brief piece on the international division that will have a vision for Oregon at the top, which may address some of your issues, Representative, but then also the biennial report, which is put out by the International Trade Commission, which is made up of both small businesses as well as large business representation, and then also materials on our individual offices. To get to your point specifically, 290 companies have been visited by our staff in the last 12 months. Since I came on board with the agency, we have 214 companies that are actively involved in our trade promotion programs. We have generated over 700 trade leads for those companies to give them opportunities to sell their products abroad. We have participated in 46 seminars in 12 different communities around the state to talk about not only the programs that the agency provides, but even more importantly, to provide technical assistance and training to those companies that are interested to get involved in the international marketplace. We have either participated in or assisted companies in the participation of 31 trade shows or other trade promotion activities in 11 countries around the world, assisting over 230 companies in that process.
Is all that in here?
No. I will give you a one-page report that will itemize all that for you, though.
Thank you, because I'm just trying to figure out, if you had 290 visits in 12 months across all of your stations here,
mm-hmm.
That doesn't strike me as a huge number of visits. And maybe I'm drawing on my experience as a small business person out making visits, trying to elicit trade relationships with companies. It just doesn't seem like a lot of visits.
And again, these are companies in the state of Oregon that we have visited with our trade managers. The way the system works is basically we provide companies with various types of assistance areas, whether it be market research, whether it be internal education issues, whether it be trade leads for sales, whether it be assistance in strategic alliances with other companies abroad. So when I say that we have actually visited and toured factories, 290 factories in the state, the number of touches of companies that we have responded to in writing or through assistance through phone calls or those type of things are significantly more than that.
I know that's not what you're asking for in this bill. I understand what you're asking
yes.
for in the bill. I'm just very curious in general how this program is performing, especially against the backdrop of the last presentation. This must be an enormously expensive program to have these contracts, and I would welcome having included in the report that you're going to provide the committee the costs for these contract relationships. What I'm trying to get a sense of is that we just had someone come in and spend the better part of 2 hours talking to us about the value of generating homegrown Oregon businesses with little tiny loans.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to get a sense of what a program of this magnitude stretched across 6 countries employing contract representation in several continents, what are the real benefits that are inuring to Oregonians for the expense in this program? And I know this has nothing to do with what you're asking for. You're asking for what seems like a quite narrow technical cleanup in the bill. But I guess I'm opening the door to take a wider look at what this delivered to Oregonians versus making little tiny loans that could let somebody set up a card shop at their house.
I understand. Let me respond in this fashion, and then I'll provide you with written materials to back it up.
Thank you.
Mr. Doyle, when you provide the materials, if you provide it to Mr. Clem, our committee administrator, he'll get it to all committee members.
I understand, Mr. Chair. In the last 12 months, companies that have utilized our services have made $2.3 million worth of sales overseas, have reported to us that they are in the process of negotiating $9.6 million worth of sales from services that they have received from us. During the same period, the state of Oregon has been the beneficiary of $670 million worth of foreign capital investment, which has created 410 jobs. So I think that if you look at it from a, if you will, dollar in, dollar out standpoint, I believe that we can show that the state of Oregon is a huge benefactor. I would also add, though this study is somewhat dated, I believe it was the National Association of Manufacturers undertook a study looking at companies that were involved in international trade versus their counterparts that were not. Basically, if you would, comparing green widget manufacturers with green widget manufacturers, one dealing on international, one dealing on a domestic side. Those that are dealing on the international side paid significantly higher wages, and forgive me for not having the exact percentages, but in the neighborhood of 20-25% higher wages. They paid comparable percentage higher benefits to their employees. Their employees were the beneficiaries of greater on-the-job training and other educational pursuits. They adapted new technologies faster than their counterparts that did not export. They developed new products at a faster rate. I think it was something like 3 to 1 than their counterparts that did not export. So from that standpoint, dealing with companies in the state, and there are over, I believe, 1,400 companies in the state currently that are doing business internationally, when you start thinking about, because of the competitive issues and the nature of that business, the benefit that their employees are gaining relative to their education, et cetera. So what we are trying to do is reach out to the small and mid-sized companies and help them get involved in that same type of growth cycle.
Believe me, I'm a convert to the concept of international trade. I'm just trying to get a sense of how expensive this program is, and now you've opened another door for me. I'm curious to know how you select what companies you're going to help. Do they come to you, or do you proactively reach out to them?
Both.
Maybe you'd include that in your report.
We utilize various multipliers, whether it be the small business development centers, local chambers of commerce, local trade associations, in communities all around the state.
Thank you.
Any questions for Mr. Doyle? Representative Bates?
Could you include in that report the financial impact of this change, if there is any?
There is no financial impact of the change in this language. It allows us with flexibility as we move through contracts to basically make sure that the contracted foreign offices are exempt as opposed to the ones where we have employees. So there is no real financial benefit today.
Other questions? Mr. Doyle, does the department have the authority now to hire contractors in foreign trade offices?
We do have that authority now. It is, in the previous language, it is more of an implied authority than a specified authority. The request here in this language makes clear the intent.
Can you let us know where the implied authority comes from, where in statute, please?
I can please. Do that.
If you can give that to committee administrator so he can get that out to all committee members. Because it seems to me we're, at least statutorily, we're expanding the authority here to use contractors, and the words establish and operate as opposed to provide managers and other employees for. What do you see as the legislative purpose there? What are we changing?
Well, I think what you are being asked to change in my discussions with the Attorney General's office and others is that traditionally Oregon has operated under a contract employee establishment for its foreign offices. The directors of our offices overseas are contract employees to the state. By doing this, it allows us to look at our offices from a contractual standpoint, where we are dealing with companies for the most part to represent us overseas as opposed to employees. And I think that's the main difference in this. The prior language, again, does not specify any exemption for those type of contractual relationships to the statutes relative to printing and other issues under the Department of Administrative Services. This just puts on paper those specific issues.
And finally, on line 25 of page 2, and we're deleting the word and adding the word or, I don't really understand what we're doing there. What's the purpose of that? If you don't know right now, Mr. Doyle, that's okay.
Well, my assumption would be that the reason that was recommended was that the two statements are mutually exclusive, but that would be just a guess.
Yeah, well, or means you're going to do one or the other, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And means you can provide these and you can provide this. So if you can maybe give us, or someone in the department can give us
we'll give you an explanation.
What's trying to be accomplished there, I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
Representative Devlin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Devlin, we have 7 minutes left, or I'm a liar to Representative Walker.
Okay. I could try to go for 20, doesn't make
it.
Mr. Doyle, just a very simple question. You're looking for explicit language in statute that should change is trying to get. You believe implied in the earlier statute you have the authority. In reality, aren't some of your firms that you haven't you already contracted with some firms directly to
yes,
perform these services?
We are using 3 firms now for those services.
So, thank you.
Okay. Other questions of Mr. Doyle? Okay, Mr. Doyle, you'll get back to us, I guess, with those
I will do
questions.
So.
We appreciate that. And if there's nothing else, I will close that public hearing. Is there any other business for the committee this evening? Any other things anybody needs to bring up? Dan, anything that you need to mention?
Yes, Representative Witt. In your packets is the summaries and the bills for the bills we didn't hear, 2103, and the bill for 2131, also the amendment for House Bill 2406. And there is some information that is not contained in the international trade folders that you were just given that's also in there as well. It basically highlights Oregon's foreign trade offices, where they're located, some basic information that will be supplemented by information that I get from Mr. Doyle. So please keep the 2103 and the 2131 bills.
I didn't sign anything for 2131. Did other people?
I didn't either. I got two 2103s. I'm going to have to figure out what's going on.
No, you got a 2103, and I held back the basic bill for 2131. Okay. If you got it, just hang on to it, is what I'm saying.
And of course, leave your blue folder, and Representative Walker? Okay, also, Friday we have, what, one bill or two bills?
We have two bills, the 2215 and the 2535.
Okay, well, those numbers. Take a look and be prepared tonight. Okay, we will plan on being done Friday, no later than, I'm going to try to be done by 5 o'clock, okay? That's the goal.
Is that a promise or a goal?
That's the goal.
would it be helpful if we were on time at 3:30? So
that would be helpful. That'd be helpful if we can get here at 3:30, 3:31, 3:32, somewhere in that time frame. Okay, we are prepared.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Particularly on bills that you're just going to forward to the end.
All right, ladies, we have time now to get ready for the event.
Big party tonight.
That first bill that you spent an hour and a half on.
You say now, okay, ladies, but I don't see anybody standing around.
The past recommendation has
the ladies, you know, we need one more time.